Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest this week is actor Ryan Kelly, who has been playing the role of Jazza in the long-running BBC radio drama The Archers for over 20 years now. He was the first blind student to attend the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. Hello, Ryan, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
So, was it a tricky task selecting your tracks then, Ryan?
You're not wrong, actually. It took me quite a while to mull them over, but I got there in the end. It just took a long time because I had to think about, you get to choose seven tracks, and there are thousands and thousands of tracks that mean something in my life. I mean, I listen to tracks, and I think of them like photographs. They evoke memories mostly, you know? And that's, you know, that for me is like, say my photograph album, I've got a certain playlist that I have on a machine that I just, sometimes I put it on and I think of home or lots of people I've met just in life generally.
And your first track is a punk track that I think you sang to a priest in a church at the age of 2. Can you remember any of that?
How true that is, I don't, I mean, it's not actually a punk track, it's a silly sort of fun track. The song is called I Want to Be a Punk Rocker, and it's by Andy Cameron. He wrote a lot of sort of football songs, sort of based on Scotland as Ali's Army and stuff like that. And this I Want to Be a Punk Rocker, as he puts it, is the B-side of this Ali's Army record that they bought out for Scotland in, I think it was 1978. But the single, you know, among Scottish people and among sort of Scottish communities was quite popular at the time, but it was the B-side that got me, and I always preferred that.
And what did the priest think of your rendition at the age of 2 then?
Father Gorman, I remember vaguely getting into trouble for singing it, but not from the priest. I don't really know what his reaction was to it. I don't remember it, but I remember Mum not being too happy when she heard about it and giving me a bit of a telling off, to be honest. If I was 2, what could you do? I mean, I was talking really early on as well. I could talk from about 4 or 5 months old, not fluently, but you know, by the age of 2 I was talking pretty fluently.
And what was sort of early life, family life like for you at that age?
We different. I mean, there was no blindness as such involved because I didn't know it was. You know, it was just a word. Up until I was about 7. And then I was visiting someone in hospital, and back then, you know, they had playrooms for kids. The kids could sort of leave the ward and go to this playroom park. And me and my sister, she was about 4 at the time, we're messing about and I bang my eye off the table. Now, I should explain to begin with, I have no eyes, it's just eye sockets there. And anyway, this woman, obviously, who was watching her own kid in the playroom, spotted that I'd banged into the table, ran me back into the ward and said, I think his eyes have fell out. And I just thought, what is she doing? She's picking me up, I don't know you from Adam, what are you playing at? So that night, Mum had to explain that my eyes were different to other people's. And I never really thought of it before that. And, you know, the concept of being blind or whatever, I thought everybody went around being guided or held by the hand. You know, I didn't know that it was any different. I didn't think about it.
And did that early performance in church set you up for your career as an actor at all?
I don't know that it did or not. I mean, it was a funny part of my life. People laugh at it still. You know, Mum, I mean, Mum's even, she's grown a sense of humour since I was 2 as well. She laughs as well. But, I mean, it's a tricky one because I've always been the type to perform. I always sort of perform to a crowd like an audience, like showing off. I used to walk along the street, we say, an auntie or whatever. I come from a big family. Mum was 1 of 8, Dad was 1 of 9. Most of them on Mum's side, lived in Corby at the time, in Northampton. And at that time, it was called Little Scotland because everybody there was either Scottish or Irish. They came down to work in the steelworks. And I went there when I was about 3. I don't really remember. Obviously, I came down for holidays because my gran lived in Corby before that, you know. But I don't really remember being in Glasgow as such, living there, because I was too young. But I know that this thing happened, this punk rocker thing happened in Corby, so it must have been, I must have been on holiday or something, you know? Yeah, it was, I don't know, I used to walk along the street with my aunties, to get back to what you're saying. And I used to copy people that walked by. And, you know, they might say anything, they might swear or anything, and I'd just copy them. I was like a parrot, just sucking everything up like a sponge, the way kids are. But because I mostly did it through audio means, physical stuff, it's still tricky to this day. You know, it's still hard to envisage a picture. I don't have pictures in my head as such because I never had sight. But I used to copy them, like old women, old men. And sometimes, it happened a couple of times where they'd hear me copy them and they'd laugh at me, you know? But I think it was that sort of listening to people and observing people audibly that made me sort of think, performance is the name of the game. I love doing this. I want to be a punk rock Albert. My mommy won't let me. She says if I'm a punk, she'll throw me and help me. I want to be a punk rock Albert.
I want to be a punk rock of air by Andy Cameron, and maybe your first ever performance, Ryan. For your next track, we are moving on only maybe a couple of years to the age of 5 or 6 and an introduction to folk music for you. Was music a big part of your family life growing up, and were your parents into music, and did you have music playing at home?
Yeah. We had, they liked a lot of reggae and a bit of Van Morrison, Bob Marley, Tyrone Taylor, UB40. McVicar soundtrack. I remember hearing that very clearly. You know, the film McVicar, the soundtrack they had to that. There's lots of other stuff as well. I mean, I lived with two aunties as well, so they were a bit like sisters, and they would play different sort of music to mum. You know, they were playing sort of modern day music at the time, which was Wham. I remember a particular one, Joanna. I think that was by Kool and the Gang. But as regards to the next song, I was we used to have to travel to school in a taxi on a Monday and then come back on a Friday, and it was about 3 hours there and 3 hours back in those days. I was in Corby and the school was in Bromsgrove. And we had this taxi driver. She was lovely, but you didn't mess with her. You know, she made Mrs. If you got on the wrong side of her, she made Mrs. Brown look like Mother Teresa. You know, she didn't take any nonsense from anyone. But she always played folk music in the car. And 3 hours there, 3 hours back, she was always the same driver. She was the head of the taxi company as well, Mrs. Flanagan. She's long gone now. She used to play stuff like the Dubliners, Foster and Allen, the Furies, all sorts of stuff, all Irish stuff. And she, it was a basic choice. There was either like, a lot of people we used to like, moan and moan and moan about it, but she didn't care. She'd just turn it up and ignore them completely. Or you could enjoy it. You know, it was either go mad or get into it. And I just thought, okay, I like this anyway. I like the fiddles. It's all a bit unusual because I haven't heard it. And they're singing in a different, slightly different accent. But the song that really got me started with it, and I remember noticing it, and it was just me and her in the taxi because she used to drop the escort off before I was dropped off. I was always the last to be dropped off. And it was this song by Foster and Allen, and it was The Spinning Wheel. Lovely tune. And I just remember noticing it. And because it was playing on a car tape recorder, I couldn't put it on again. So I waited until like the next week when she was playing it, and I got everybody to be quiet so I could actually sit and learn the verses. But that is where I remember singing it at home at the weekend. I went home and I sang one of the choruses of it, and I didn't even know what I was singing. You know, I must have been about 5 or 6, as I said. And yeah, my uncle went, "Ryan, you're singing Irish music," and I didn't even realize I was singing in an Irish accent. You know, I loved the tune, loved the words, and that was enough for me. But that was my introduction to folk.
And the school that you went to, was that a school for visually impaired children as well?
Yeah, it was what was called either a blind school, which I always thought was hilarious, or a special school, I said again. But the blind school was the best. I mean, have you ever seen a building with eyes? I don't know about you, but I haven't. All places, all buildings are blind. Yes, it was. It was not my favourite place to be. I think they got it wrong in a lot of cases because they sent kids away who were really, really young, away from their homes. And I remember going to the school, and I thought that, because when you're that age, when you're 5 or so, you think, well, what can I do to fit in? And I used to actually speak with an English accent, more English like that, to fit in at school. And I'd go back to doing the Scottish accent at the weekend, you know, because I didn't feel like I fitted in unless I did that. But the one thing I missed when I went away to school, and I think that's why I did it, the one thing I missed was everybody around me being Scottish, the accent. Everybody spoke like that or like that or like that. It was just, it was not hardly a Scottish person among them. There wasn't, the few I did come across were usually, you know, they weren't, I don't know, they were part English. They didn't feel, at that age, didn't feel comfortable because I was used to the accent of Glaswegian or Scottish all around me.
Mellow the moonlight to shine is beginning. Close by the window, young Eileen is spinning. Bent o'er the fire, her blind grandmother.
The Spinning Wheel there by Foster and Allen, and your first introduction to folk music, Ryan. For your next track, we come to one by the Proclaimers, and I think one that you first heard of a sort of group in a different accent. Had music always been a bit British for you then? And was the Proclaimers the sort of first introduction to a different accent?
Well, no, my first introduction to that was Billy Connolly. You know, sort of he dared to sing in his own accent, and that was all fine, but a band that actually did it and weren't frightened to do it. You know, there was a lot of tracks that I could have done. Really had to sift through the Proclaimers tracks that, you know, that I wanted to choose, but it was hard. But I love the difference in that track. It's got a sort of folky pop ring to it. It's got both, and they were singing in their own accents. And I remember thinking when I was about 12, when I heard it on a vinyl, it was one of the last LPs I actually heard. I remember thinking, how brave is that? And they're singing this song. This song is about, you know, the lines, I can't understand why we let someone else rule our land cap in hand. They're on about England. And I just thought, that's really brave of them. And they're singing out against this, but in the nicest possible way. They're not, there's no vitriol, you know. These guys just to me were just so brave because they sang in their own accents and, you know, they were proud of the fact.
I can tell a meaning of a word like serene. I got some old grief that I was 16. I can tell the difference between margarine and butter. I can see Saskatchewan without starting.
The Proclaimers there and Cap in Hand. We now come to a track, Ryan, that you have dedicated to your wife, Sonia. How did you and Sonia first meet, and did it happen quite fast, you and Sonia getting together, or did it take a bit of time?
Well, there's a story there. When I was 16, I was with Sonia. We were both at school together, and I was in Warwickshire by that time. And yes, we went out together, sort of childhood sweethearts thing for about a year and a half. And I ended it, actually, because I was going to college, going to RNC in Hereford. And I ended it because I didn't want to be tempted by anything. And I wanted us both to be sort of free. Anyway, about 5 weeks later, I was regretting this very deeply. I was not good. It wasn't good that I did this. And, you know, time, I went to RNC for 3 years and then I went to Bristol for two. And in the second year, I was talking to a friend of mine who I was actually at Exo with, and I've always kept in touch with her. And she said to me, well, I often see Sonia at college. And I thought to myself, what college do they go to in the afternoons from Exel? And it could only be North Warwickshire and Hinckley College. So I gave the college a ring and, you know, left them a number to give to Sonia and see if she would phone me back. Anyway, she did that same night. And the fact is, I've never looked back. You know, I have a great job and a cracking family. And that starts with Sonia. You know, there's, in my eyes, there's no one better.
And as you mentioned, you studied the performing arts at the Royal National College for the Blind in Hereford with Amanda, and as you say, went on to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School to become an actor. And I wondered, sort of, what were those times in Hereford like, and how much of a grounded did they give you for your time in Bristol at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School? Because you were, I think, the first blind student to go to the Bristol Old Vic.
Yes, well, that was an extraordinary time in my life. Amanda and John Everett as well, I should say, gave me a good grounding in it because, you know, they acted sort of good cop, bad cop, and they were great at it. You know, they were really good at the jobs and totally to be admired. Even now, I can't think of them without a little lump in my throat, because they got me through. You know, they got me worthy of being an old Vickian, if you will. But I remember sitting in what was then was called the recital room. It was a great performance room and lovely acoustics. It wasn't overly big, but it, you know, I just had the best acoustics in the world. And I remember sitting in there with her, and she just said, "You should go to theatre school." Now, I hadn't thought of what theatre school and what it meant, really. I just thought, well, that only happens in black and white films. Sort yourself out. So I asked the representative, "Shut up, sort yourself out. How am I going to get into theatre school?" You know? And she just, you know, push, as Amanda did, and she got me there. I got an audition just at the end of my time at RNC, 3 years in. But I did lots of shows at RNC, which, you know, I knew I could do sort of do the vocal stuff, but I wasn't 100% sure of the physical. And that was where they helped, you know, what physicality needs to happen. And they made, you know, ever since then, I mean, I learned more about that at Bristol, but that's where I started to learn about proper physicality at RNC.
And what's life like in Bristol like? Was it all fun and games and stuff? And was it, you know?
Well, it was a lot to get used to at the time, because I'd always been in an institution. I'd lived, I don't know, the last 8 months outside, but that was a college house. It was owned by RNC. And so there was always a sort of link with the college there. You could always sort of get back in touch, you know, sort of get sorted out if you needed help, that sort of thing. But when I went to Bristol, it was all fresh. It was all new. And it was, you know, I'd never sort of handled my own digs and stuff before. But it was about living as well, you know, and I learned some extraordinary things at Bristol, not only about technique and acting and different things, but about life and about how to live it.
Yeah, and there must have been some great times there. And, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I've had great times. Mostly in my life, I've been happy. You know, one of the biggest things I can say, and not everybody can say this, so I've kept myself very lucky indeed, is I've known myself to be loved ever since I was born. There's never been a time where I was swept under the carpet or left out of anything or singled out. I've always just known love from starting with my parents, you know, my aunties, uncles, cousins. And I've been lucky to have that because not everybody does. But that was the basis on sort of what, you know, starting to learn about life and about acting. It's about people, isn't it? The whole thing is about people. And I just think that I did okay, and I learned more at Bristol than I've learned anywhere else in my life, I think, you know, about acting technique and about starting to live life for myself.
And what is the track that you have dedicated to Sonia, and what memories come back to you when you hear it?
Well, actually, I'm getting one in here because, that's what I call it anyway. She chose a song, our wedding song. We got married in 2004. Oh, it's a good job I remembered that. I'd be in trouble else. we were married in 2004, and she chose to have "Everything I Do It For You" by Bryan Adams. Now, I was never happy about it, but she wanted her granddad to be with her in spirit. He died, so I understood, you know. But I always wanted this song, because it described us more accurately. The words, the lyrics were more apt to us, and I just thought, you know what, this is my chance.
Thinking about all our younger years, there was only you and me. We were young and wild and free. Now nothing can take you away from me.
Bryan Adams there, and Heaven, and a track dedicated to your wife, Sonia Ryan. Your next track is one for your daughter, Bethany, and this might sound like a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How easy or difficult did you and Sonia find it bringing up Bethany? Because as you are both visually impaired, and do you have any tips for other visually impaired parents?
Well, there was a whole thing about this. When I remember, I mean, I'll tell you about this first. We'd done a show, and it was written by a guy who was partially sighted, and who shall also remain nameless. He'd written this show from a partially sighted perspective. So every single line, or almost every single line, had to be changed ever so slightly. There were certain things that he'd said, you know, I think I'll go home and give my dog a kick. I was on stage with my guide dog at the time, Ben. And I wasn't happy about saying that because it's, you know, people don't kick their guide dogs. It's not the sort of persona that you want to put out to the public. And I just, you know, I objected to all sorts of things that he'd written, and we had to change it, you know, because I wasn't going to do it. Because he'd written it, you know, that as though the guy could see at times even. You know, he was forgetting that the guy was totally blind. Anyway, that's not really it. We did the show, and everything about this show was absolutely perfect. You know, it was really good. Everything went well, all the moves, everything went well. I actually had to throw a bottle of so-called tablets that were M&Ms, and I aimed it at this person. And I, all the rehearsals, I hadn't got it right, but this time I got it right in the face with all of them. It was really good. But anyway, so the 6 weeks of rehearsing, rewriting culminated in a really good show for the first night. And I've come off stage, and obviously all mobile phones are off. You know, you don't have them around, you don't have them on. And I picked up my messages, and it was Sonia getting increasingly impatient to tell me that she was pregnant with Bethany. I was working in Bristol, Sonia was in Nuneaton. And anyway, I was blown away because, you know, that was truly the best night of my life. Not so much Bethany being born, I was too mixed. But when she was announced, and I also, we pulled this show off really well. I've never had that sort of feeling before or since. You know, it was an amazing feeling. And it was just, I can't describe it. It was beyond words. But that was the start of it, you know. And I remember sitting and thinking at night after I got home and sort of calmed down a little bit. I didn't sleep for a long, long time. And I remember thinking the only thing, and this is actually turned out to be true, the only thing we couldn't do at the time was to pour the water on top of the baby milk, because we couldn't judge the amount of water to the amount of baby milk. We couldn't tell, because you've got to get that right so that the child is, you know, it gets its right nutrients and things. Sonia couldn't feed Bethany via the breast because of medication. You know, she was on a lot of medication for epilepsy, so she couldn't do that. And that was the only thing we couldn't do. And through Sonia's pregnancy, there was a lot of people questioning our ability to sort of bring up a child and raise a child. But we managed okay. Bethany's 21 now. She's 21 at Christmas. She's a good kid. She loves her animals. She works with dogs. She's doing a hydrotherapy course. So we must have done something okay, you know. We're very lucky with her.
How much love and joy has Bethany brought into yours and Sonia's life then?
Oh, well, I can't talk about that because I don't have the words for it. When she was born, I was obviously numb, you know, that's the night she was born. It was 2 days after Christmas, and it was about 2:10 in the morning, and it was freezing cold. I wasn't feeling a thing. I was just like, yeah, okay, well, Sonia's in the hospital. I've got the night to myself. Let's take the dogs for a walk at 2:10 in the morning. So I took mine and Sonia's dogs out, and I just sat on the edge of this bridge. I didn't feel anything for about 2 hours. The dogs came back to me as if to say, come on, take us home, man. Play fair. Come on. You know, and that was because of pure happiness. The only way I can describe it is that when you lose someone, it's the absolute opposite to that, the absolute opposite to grief. There is nothing like it. And since then, what a journey. What a journey. I can't really say more than that. It's been amazing.
The track that you have chosen that is dedicated to Bethany is a Waterboys track by Ellie Goulding. Why this particular one? Because I think she's done a fairly good job of it, but why this particular track?
Because, I mean, the Waterboys did it, didn't they? They did it too. They did it first. The Ellie Goulding version, for me, feels more serene. It feels more like you actually are holding a baby. You know, it's a sort of the backing you would might hear in a lullaby or something like that. And I knew twice in my life I've wished I could see. Once when I first got my first guide dog, and the second time for about, and these have not lasted more than a couple of seconds. Second time when Bethany was born, you know, to be able to see her and know what sex she was, know that sort of thing, and to know straight away that I regretted not being able to see. Only twice in my life that I regret not being able to see, I've hated it. But the minute I held her in my arms, it's completely stopped mattering. It didn't matter at all, you know. And all I know is that when I did that, I knew that I'd do anything for her.
How long will I love you? As long as stars are above you, and longer if I may.
How Long Will I Love You There by Ellie Goulding, and a track dedicated to your daughter, Bethany Ryan. Before we talk about your next track, I wondered if you didn't mind talking a bit about playing the character of Jazza in The Archers, because I don't think many listeners to The Archers will probably realise that Jazza is being played by a blind actor. How much has the character of Jazza developed over the years, and is there much of you in his character at all?
I think Jazza has developed very much over the past 21 years. You know, when he came into it, it was a little bit two-dimensional. He was a drug addict. He nicked cars. I mean, I love the fact that I was the first, well, that I know of, the world's first ever blind car thief. I thought that was hilarious. But it was Jazza, obviously, wasn't, but I was. I just held on to that. It's one of my moments. And yeah, I think he's developed a lot. He's come on a lot. He's learned a lot through certain people like Neil and Tom as well, of course, but mostly through Jim Lloyd. Anybody that listens to The Archers will know that Jim and Jazza started off as what people called at work anyway. They called them the odd couple, because you've got an old man living with a younger man. You know, Jazza thinks he's the eternal teenager, but he's 36. He was 36 this year. And it was just such a strange combination, but somehow it works. I mean, some of the storylines as well have made, you know, the forced Jazza to develop more. We had the historic abuse thing a couple of years ago. That was with Jim Lloyd. And I think that's probably the hardest one, the hardest storyline I've been a part of. But not so much for this sort of the acting and things, but you've got to try and be in the zone with that sort of thing. And to think about that too much got quite depressing at times, especially when you had a lot of reps to do in a month, you know. Well, I love doing it as well, but it got me down at certain times. I won't deny it. But I really enjoy the playing. I love doing the work, you know. I love learning the lines, because obviously everybody else gets to read the lines off a script. You try to read Braille over a microphone, you can hear it. It's like a little Geiger counter noise. You can't get around that. I mean, you probably could with a Braille display or something, but my memory works okay, so I'm happy with that. You know, it's fine. But yeah, that's part of it. You know, sort of achieving, learning the lines, coming out of the studio. And it's the best feeling, one of the best feelings in the world, when you're going home and thinking, I've actually achieved this and it's happened. You know, and I love playing Jazza, but as to Jazza being a bit like me, yes, he certainly is. I mean, I hear certain other people in his voice when I'm doing it, especially when I've had to do like drunk Jazza, certain things. I've heard my Uncle John, my Uncle Jim, you know, when they've been drunk, or even an auntie, my Auntie Angie, she's come into his character sometimes. But basically, I tend to pull all sorts of people in. But yes, he is a big part of me now. Inevitably, he is.
Do you feel freer in radio than maybe on stage or on screen as an actor? Because
definitely, yes.
Yeah, because as you say, you know, you can play any character, you can do anything you like. You can ride motorbikes, you can drive a car, and those sorts of things which you probably wouldn't be allowed to do on the road.
Well, they wouldn't let me. I did try, but they wouldn't have it. But yeah, that's the thing. It frees you up so much more, because all you're using is your voice and your body to create certain effects, you know. And you could be anything on radio, because I mean, let's face it, the camera never lies. I've only ever played characters that were blind on TV. Theatre I've done a bit more, but that was mostly through school and experimental theatre. I did a thing years ago, War Music, Christopher Logue, and it was done in complete darkness, so some people couldn't cope with it. One person was even sick, I remember, because she just couldn't cope with the darkness, the sort of, and for me, it was the norm. You know, I was eating sweets and all sorts, but when I was waiting to perform, like, yeah, all right, I can do what I like here because nobody can see me. But yeah, I think on the whole, it's right. Radio is my favourite medium, voice of any kind is my favourite sort of medium.
And I think your next track that you've chosen is an uplifting one. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Yes, it was Let's Think About Living by Bob Luman. Now, it's a bit dated, I must say. particularly in the second verse, but the chorus makes up for all. It's just, it makes you want to throw all the bad stuff away. You know, if your day's not going well, play that song, and whether your day goes badly, carries on going badly or not, you'll still feel better for having heard that chorus a couple of times. You know, it cheers you up, or it does me anyway. It works for me.
I'm wondering why. Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living.
Bob Luman and Let's Think About Living there. Before we talk about your final track, Ryan, I wanted to ask you a question, whether you know, because you sort of, I think you're quite a happy kind of person, and you've obviously had a pretty, I suppose, good life so far. You know, you met your wife, Sonia, you've had your baby daughter, Bethany. Do you feel that life is good for you? And do you think that you've achieved all those sorts of things you wanted to achieve in life, becoming an actor and playing a character in a national radio show?
I didn't expect. I mean, I used to listen to The Answers. I've listened to it since I was 11, on and off. I don't say that it was constant, but, you know, I've always listened to it. And I remember odd times, I'd love to be doing that. I'd dream of being in something like that. And I'm living the dream. So, I mean, that side of it doesn't get much better. You know, it's amazing. And as for family life, I mean, I've got such a big family, including, you know, mum and so on. As I said, mum was one of eight, and dad was one of nine. So all those cousins and things are pen, you know, there's lots of them. And to have all those people to be around and to experience life from was a big gift for me, you know. I mean, and as for life being happy, if I look back, I mean, yeah, there's obviously been down times, and there has for everyone in life. But I look back and the happiness far, far outweighs the bad times, definitely.
Well, we now come to your final track, the one that you would like to pass on that might give people hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Well, I think this track, it's not so much about hope, it's about happiness. It's about making you smile. And that can be the start of hope, I think, anyway. The track, I mean, I first heard it when I was 10, and I was rolling on the floor. I had to listen to it again and again to calm down. And even now, when I first hear that chorus, even if I'm feeling dour and miserable or grumpy about nothing, you know, it makes me smile. It makes me grin from ear to ear. I can't help it. It's just that after that, I calm down. But anything that makes you smile, you know, makes you feel good for the future, surely. That's what I'd have thought. Anyway, the track is, and it's quite an old track, The Laughing Policeman by Charles Penrose. And the end of the track, I imagine this would have been recorded live, given the quality of it. But the end of the track almost sees him going over the edge and losing himself in laughter. And I just think that's great. There's nothing like a good laugh.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Ryan Kelly, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
And thank you very much for listening, Toby. Take care.